Welcome to an amazing jam-packed episode of the Student Loan Planner podcast. First, I want to start off introducing one of our newest consultants, Molly. Molly, welcome to the team.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
Can you just share for our audience a little bit about your background and a little bit about why we had to have you today with me and Rob to talk about just investing in 2021 and if it's a bubble or not?
Sure. So I am from and still live in Dallas, Texas. I'm a little bit north of there now. But as far as investments go, that's something that I've spent most of my financial planning related career on. I worked for a large RIA or investment firm that managed about $4 billion. And I worked specifically on the investment team. So that's picking mutual funds for clients, picking the right allocation for clients, doing research on our current and potential funds that we might want to invest in, largely mutual fund based, not a lot of individual stocks or ETFs, but that's sort of where I've cut my teeth in the industry. So I'm excited about today.
Awesome. And also you're probably the most qualified from a credentialing standpoint of anyone on the team now. Can you explain the credentials that you have?
I have a lot of letters. I have a MAMBA, which is a Master's of Art and a Master's of Business together at once. So an MA, MBA. I also have my CFP designation and my CFA designation. And I'm working on the CSLP. I expect to have that by the end of this month.
Like I joke that I'm the least qualified in this conversation because we're going to pick on Rob next. So Rob, tell everybody about your experience in the investment world.
Oh, I've got a lot of it because I'm the old fogey on the team. I believe it or not, I'm coming up on my 20-year anniversary of being involved in the investment industry, if you can believe that.
Oh my gosh.
Started back in 2001 professionally, but going back into the 90s, you know, I was in college, had a little bit of money and invested during the tech bubble, the tech run-up and burst of the bubble. Then I did equity trading in New York from 2002 to 2004. So coming out of that tech bubble burst and out of that recession. We were basically trading stocks for individuals, high net worth individuals, mutual funds, hedge funds. Those were our kind of clients. And then after that, I got into investment management, got my CFA, and did investment management, specifically stock selecting, designing individual portfolios of about 40 to 50 securities that we thought would outperform over time. Did that for about 11 years before I started my own company and started working here.
That's awesome. So each one of us has traded or managed or been involved in the investment process with billions of dollars individually, which I think is pretty cool. And the reason why I wanted to have this combination of folks on today is just with that chartered financial analyst, charter holder designation, it doesn't mean that we have any special skills or insights compared to anybody else, but it is one of the most challenging, I think it's fair to say, credentials in the financial industry. And you typically see it with people that manage, you know, big portfolios or at institutions. So I think our conversation today will be a little bit more technical than maybe some of our listeners might enjoy. But at the same time, I think it's worthwhile to go into technical details so you can get a deeper level understanding of what is going on with financial markets right now. And just in general, what's the investment landscape's like. So I think a lot of our listeners are aware, but just a quick 30-second spiel about my investment background. So I used to be a bond trader, traded personally about $10 billion worth of bonds, kind of like a really crazy experience saying, you know, negotiating with a big Wall Street bank on like a $10 million individual bond issue, you know, loan for one of our portfolios. There's just all kinds of crazy memories and experiences going through that. So that was a fun experience, as I'm sure a lot of y'all's different trading experience was. I thought I would just start off today's podcast. Obviously, we have our investment course, which we're not talking about today. This is just purely about investing in general. We're going to talk about the state of the market and what's going on and kind of what does it mean for our folks who are investors as well as student loan borrowers. So I guess my first question, let's put this one towards Rob here. Are we in a bubble?
Oh, of course you give that to me. So I've been through the tech bubble. I was in the bubble leading up to the Great Recession. And then now we're in this time period. So is it technically a bubble? You know, things are certainly frothy. So the way that I think about stocks and asset prices in general, like housing prices are going through the roof. Stock prices are going through the roof. Bond prices are going through the roof. The thing that makes this different than any other time is that interest rates are at historic lows. So the way that I think about investing is you're kind of like competing for the best returns. So if you have the choice of, like back when I was a young kid, you know, I think in the early 2000s, cash was paying 5%. bonds were paying 7% and stocks were, you know, price yield about 9%. You know, if you wanted to take extra risk, then you would take that extra risk to get an extra 4% return. But today interest rates are zero. The 10-year treasury is like 1% or 1.5%. So if you want to get a good return, where are you going to go? You're going to go to the stock market. And so because of that, and because interest rates are so low, it makes the cost of ownership of things a lot cheaper. So it inflates the prices. So I think we're sort of in a bubble, because if interest rates go up, I think that's when the wheels start to fall off.
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly something that I'm worried about, just interest rates increasing, what that's going to mean for our economy. Molly, what do you think about that question of just, are we in a bubble?
Short answer, yes. I think we've been getting there since about 2013, which is the really strange thing, because things have been expensive. Things have been a little frothy. If you just look at straight numbers and look at history, for several years, we've been thinking that a market correction, or basically a short-term pain, is coming for such a long time. And yet things keep going up. So it's a really strange period to be investing. My own dollar investing was in 2007, right before 2008. And my little bit of money that my grandmother gave me fell 50%. So I know what this excitement feels like, and then what could be coming, but we don't know exactly when.
I think one thing that I like to tell our listeners, people don't really understand present value. We talk about it in our student loan consults a lot, because you can't look at $100,000 over 10 years the same way you'd look at it over 30 years. But a lot of people do. They just look at, what is the absolute cost? Tech companies, right? Why would you guys say tech companies have just killed it the past 20 years in terms of valuations because of low interest rates? Like, why would that matter in terms of like the valuation of future profits?
I would say my feeling on tech stocks is that this has happened before. I don't think this is specifically answering your question, but eventually earnings have to justify a price. That's what the PE ratio is, price divided by earnings. And so the fact that we're seeing companies like Tesla trade at such a high price and people getting such great return, the earnings are just now turning positive. So that's when we talk about this being kind of a crazy time and potentially a bubble. Eventually, a lot of these tech companies, unless the technology is so unique and so different that it completely changes the space, that's what we're talking about when things are expensive, that the earnings have to catch up or this can't go on forever.
So it's always dangerous when you ask a question looking for a specific answer, right? Because you can't read my mind. So like present value. So like if Facebook is expected to earn $1 million in 50 years, the interest rate is what determines what you would pay for that today. And we know that like a stock price at the end of the day is just the discounted present value of cash flows. And from a technical standpoint, what does that mean for like the listener that's listening to this? It's like a dentist or a veterinarian or like a lawyer, you know, somebody that's not, you know, a physician, right? Not somebody that's not like a financial professional. It's just like, take all the money that a company is expected to earn ever and then figure out a way to value all that today. And that's what the value of the company should be. One reason why Tesla, you could argue that Tesla's valuation is accurate, like Rob was saying, like with super low interest rates, if Tesla's expected future profits are like 50 years away and we're expecting them to have all the software in the world's cars and be powering our homes through battery packs attached to our cars. I guess you mentioned you're in Texas, right, Molly? So maybe, you know, if you'd had a Tesla, maybe we would have, you know, it would have been a little better, right, during this price. I'm just joking around here. But so if you kind of assume those things, well, then if you assume an interest rate of 7% for $1 million 50 years into the future, then the value of that in today's dollars is worth about $33,000 or so. And if you assume a 3% interest rate, then that $1 million in 50 years is worth $228,000. So that's like a 7 times more in terms of the valuation you'd have in today's dollars from interest rates being low. And so since interest rates are being super low, like I guess it makes sense why like Jeff Bezos is the richest guy in the world, because investors haven't needed to punish him for not having a profit for so long while building his company. Because interest rates have just been going down, 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 down. And now we have very low interest rates where people are expecting to stay that way. And so that's what people want, is like the hope of like massive future profits, which you get way more excited with somebody like Elon Musk, that you could see having $500 billion in profits in 50 years versus, you know, something like Coca-Cola, which will maybe be either flat or like maybe even a lot less, you know, depending on consumers' future tastes. it feels like a bubble, but it's also a little scary to call it that because like there's really good reasons why the market's valued what it's valued at today.
Right. You know, I think the problem comes when we take these expectations of future growth and we project them too far into the future. There's this great investor, his name is Jeremy Grantham. He's been around like 40, 50 years, value guy. That's when the problem happens. As we've seen from the tech bubble, from the great leading up to the Great Recession, these runs can go forever. I mean, just because it's a bubble now doesn't mean the market can't double again. So I wouldn't want to bet against it. In terms of valuations today, so let's take Apple, for example. So Apple is trading at, I think, like 33 times earnings. If you flip that PE ratio that you were talking about before, Molly, over, that works out to be a 3% earnings yield. So we take that earnings yield of 3% compared to the interest rates. Now, Apple is a very stable company. They own every single device that all of us have for the most part. So to get a 3% earnings yield for a high quality company, that might make sense. So Apple could be fairly valued. Whereas like when the iPhone and the iPod first came out in the mid-2000s, people didn't fully appreciate how big it would be. And so the stock price was cheap back then, even though in like current days, it looked like it was expensive. But now it's probably fairly priced based upon what else you can get. People forget the stock market is not all that big. And so if you want to invest in quality stocks like Apple or Amazon, there's only so many places you can flow your money. And when it gets there, that's when things start to come up. So things are getting frothy. Some things are fairly valued. Some things seem to be wildly overvalued. So like Tesla, for example, that was the other point I was going to say. Tesla's trading at like 20 times sales. Travis, what is the average multiple that like a dental practice is selling for these days?
Like 0.6 to one time sales, typically.
Okay, so $1 million dental practice top line is probably worth about $600,000 to buy it. Something like that?
Something like that. Yeah, $600,000 to $800,000 maybe.
Okay, so at a 20 times sales multiple, that same dental practice would be worth $20 million.
Oh, man.
For $1 million worth of revenue.
Can we like convince some of these stock people that there's like some electric cars being made in this dental practice or something? I mean, shoot.
Right, exactly. So when we put it in terms of like practice ownership and apply these multiples to stuff like that, I mean, there's no way that we would ever advise a dentist to pay $20 million for $1 million practice.
That's really interesting. What do you think about just like the nature of like how, Molly, like credit spreads right now, like which is just like how much extra yield investors expect to take on a lot of risk? People are not afraid of it at all. People are requiring the lowest additional yield to buy junk bonds in decades right now. What is your thoughts on how people are just totally unafraid of risk?
Well, I think that they look in their bank accounts and they see that they're making pennies every single year. You know, even looking at money market funds, any kind of, you know, I get so many clients asking over the years that I've been in this, you know, how can I get more on my cash? Because of that time that Rob mentioned where you could get 4 to 5%, there really isn't a choice. So how do I feel about it? We really want to be aware and don't put all of your bond allocation, if you have a bond allocation, in junk bonds, because they're called junk for a reason. I mean, there's a really high potential of default, meaning that you might not get your money back on a bond that is technically supposed to be one of the safer things to invest in. And so if you don't want to take equity-like risk on a bond, which in times like this, bonds can kind of trade a little bit more like an equity. So I would say that we have to get returns somehow. I think diversification is really important, meaning owning more than one type of bond and more than one type of stock globally. Global diversification is also important. But yeah, I mean, people have to get some kind of return if you want to grow your wealth over time.
Let's talk about a hot trend in the stock market lately. People might have seen this a lot, called SPACs. Special purpose acquisition vehicle, I think, or acquisition company, I guess, is the technical abbreviation. Either one of you, if you want to talk about what SPACs are, and you know, one of our partner companies, SoFi, is trying to go public right now through a SPAC. So what does that mean and why does that matter?
A SPAC, which I thought was SPAC until recently, because even though they've been around 20 years, they've become really popular recently in the news. A SPAC is also called a blank check company. So essentially a small group of investors puts cash into a vehicle or kind of writes a check into a vehicle that goes public. They haven't purchased anything yet. They haven't become a viable company really yet, other than that they have cash in the bank. So over a certain amount of time, 2 to 3 years. It depends on the SPAC, really. But they go out and they find a private company that might have a lot of debt attached to it. So a traditional initial public offering or IPO would not be available for them. They work with that company to take it public. They already have something on an exchange that is public. So basically, you have an IPO, then you have a period where they try to take a company public. If you are somebody that invested initially into the SPAC, then you get shares of the new public company for a fixed cost, and you get something called warrants that also allows you basically access to more of the equity of the company. So they're really complicated, I guess, is the short story there, but it's a way for companies to go public if they couldn't qualify for a traditional initial public offering or IPO.
They might qualify, right? But like, what about, you mentioned something before we press the record about the last time that these were being used heavily. What's like the real point to these things?
The real point is we saw a huge increase in SPAC activity in 99 or 2000, which, Rob, maybe you can talk a little bit more. I was actually not graduated from high school at that point, but maybe you could give us a little more idea of what happened back then.
Yeah, I don't know at the time exactly what SPACs were and how they were used, but I know that they were like these holding companies that would sort of hold their cash, right, until they would find the right tech company to take public. You know, the private equity markets are really tough to get into unless someone has a lot of money or like a good banking connection. And so this is a way for the individual investor, the democratization of investing, which to me is a good thing. More people have access to these kind of investment opportunities. When you started seeing these things really take off, I mean, these SPACs were trading at premiums. You know, like normally you'd think that what would you pay for a fund that has $100 million in cash? Well, it should be worth about $100 million. And then depending on what the opportunity was to invest, maybe you'd pay a premium because whatever they're going to buy should be worth more than that. But what happens is these SPACs are trading above the value of the companies they're even trying to acquire. And so you're like buying a bubble within a bubble. You're like paying a premium price for something that's going to pay a premium price for another company. And even beyond that, the fees in these SPACs, like the people who start these SPACs, they are making an absolute fortune. Like 20 to 25% of the money raised in these SPACs goes towards that. Then they get paid like $1 million a year to try to find the companies, the right company. So I think that they are a great tool to bring privately held companies to market faster because the process of going public is like, takes forever. But, you know, I think buyer beware of these things too. Now, again, people know what short selling is, where you sell something in anticipation of it going down. Like, I never really want to short into a market like this because you could just lose a ton of money. But at the same time, you know, it's like you got to be cautious about where you're throwing your money these days.
Yeah. I mean, like the points about just getting the money out as quick as possible, right? I saw this really good Twitter post the other day. It was a picture of Cancun Airport. The headline for the post was "Good luck with your 1% bonds." And it showed the Cancun airport a couple weeks ago, all the people waiting a baggage claim. There was no social distancing. This thing looked like a mosh pit of people. Everybody was like 6 inches apart from everybody else. It was just absolutely packed. And that's all Americans, obviously, that are looking to escape and go on vacation. And so in other words, we did this survey and like people have a ton of money on the sidelines. Like our borrowers right now, like they haven't had to pay student loans for a while and they get to not pay until September. You guys, I'm just going to be honest, like 3% unemployment rate among our borrowers. People have the biggest emergency funds they've ever had. And people are looking for places to spend this money. And so yet we have 1.5% bonds. We could have some serious inflation coming out of this. And so I think that like y'all are both saying, when you have high interest rates, the valuations of these future profits and these tech companies, especially in speculative companies, goes way down. The value of these future profits declines a ton, which means their valuations would be way less. And the company founders and owners and investors would also get paid a lot less. So, you know, these SPACs, they're trying to get this done in a couple months versus wait like 6 months where we could have the markets be way lower than they are now. The takeaway message, at least for me, is it's just evidence of like lots of froth in the market and that people that are very smart are anticipating that we could have a really big correction at some point in the next year. And that's why they're trying to do this. I don't know.
there's a lot of parallels between the early 2000s and now, in that there were a bunch of tech stocks, which back then was a lot of websites. Pets.com was at one point a really popular stock. And so if we saw SPAC activity, we saw a lot of small tech companies becoming huge deals in 2000. And then we had a tech correction and a tech crisis. Is that what we're going through now? We don't know yet, but there's some similarities between the two time periods.
So like one thing I think is important to let our listeners know is back in 2001, 2002, like if you bought at the peak of the bubble, you're still way up now. Like you've still made a ton of money, right? Like I think, Rob, that's like something that people like don't really think about a lot, right? Like if you bought at the peak of a bubble, like you'd presume that you'd have way less money than, you know, now because of that. Like, why is that not the case?
I mean, it's compound interest, right? So like I remember in 2000, when we crossed over NASDAQ 5,000, that was like the big marker. That was like the tech index, NASDAQ 5,000, that was the thing. Well, the NASDAQ hit a little bit over 5,000 and then it crashed down to like 2,000 in the bottom in 02. And today the NASDAQ's at 13,000. So even if you bought at 5,000, that's still almost a triple over the last 20 years. But what we had is, you know, we had 100% run up 97, 98, 99. A 50% drop. So you're like back to even. Then we had another 100% run up into 08 with another 50% drop. So now you're back to even again. But from 08 to now, I mean, aside from the dip in March with the pandemic and everything like that, which has recovered, people forget that for 20 years, well, maybe not 20 years, but for like 15 years, the market was like flat. Like someone invested at the top of 2000, it was flat. But over time, because stocks usually outperform because you're buying quality companies, they should grow over time. You know, because of market weighted indices, the best run companies become a bigger and bigger weight of the index, which makes it go up more and more. But that's why kind of like with dollar cost averaging, which you always talk about, Travis, you want to buy more as the market drops and less as the market goes up. And that's if someone who dollar cost averaged would do even better than what the indexes have done. I don't know if that answers your question, though. Does that answer your question?
No, it does, I think. So, Molly, like somebody who doesn't have a lot of money right now, who's got $10,000 in the stock market, who's worried that they maybe need to pull out everything because of listening to this podcast, because we're saying there could be a bubble. Why would like an automated regular investment plan be a good antidote to that fear?
The biggest thing, I was actually kind of itching to answer this, so I'm glad you asked it, is something that is a little bit more automated that maybe you feel you can hand the reins over to, take some of your emotion out of the equation. I spoke about it previously, or just a few minutes ago, that my initial money went down 50% in 2008. It was the worst timing ever to get into the market in the first place. But that money, if I had gotten out, that's a recognized loss. So if you put $100 in, it goes down to 50 and then you sell, you only have $50. You can't get that 50 back unless you reinvest it. It's really difficult to decide when to reinvest it when you've just made such a big decision like selling at the bottom or selling right now even. If you had just stayed in, so I invested, it went down 50%. It's now over triple. That same dollar amount is over triple what my initial investment was. So if I had gotten out, or I had moved to cash, or if I had bought bonds instead and sold, it would have taken me decades to get back, probably. But where we are now, I stayed invested. I you know, just kind of turned a blind eye to what might happen in the market. And you end up, because of compounding interest, like Rob talked about, you end up so much better off. I guess my point is stay invested, and with something like a robo-advisor or something that's automatically picking your allocation for you, let it do the work. Let it rebalance for you. Don't get out just because of the maybe scary stuff we're talking about today.
Yeah. I mean, so like we talk about market beta in the financial industry sometimes, which is just basically like how much is something correlated with the economy and the market. You know, I mean, an index fund is a beta of one because it goes literally up and down with exactly the performance of the economy and the markets. So I think like our listeners, you actually have a very uncorrelated beta to what the economy is doing, because a lot of our listeners are healthcare practitioners, people who, you know, have stick to the ribs kind of money and income that they can count on. I just want to emphasize to you, the listener, that you have decades ahead of you of wealth growth. The very best thing in the world right now for you financially would be that there would be a significant correction in the markets. And then this is 2021 investing a bubble? If the answer to that is yes, you should be thrilled. You should not be upset about it. Like, people like us that are in the financial industry are going to get whacked way harder than you will, because our, I guess, advice or, you know, our livelihoods are a little bit more correlated to how markets are doing. Whereas people that have a lot of stability in your income, you're the kind of person that can be investing and buying ever increasing shares of companies and ever increasing ownership in companies. As the markets go down, you're buying an increasing share of ownership in those companies, as long as you keep up a regular automated investing plan. So I'll ask Molly another question to you. Is buying bonds dumb right now?
I think you and I might disagree on this. So my feeling is that there are opportunities as long as you buy a diversified set of bonds. Generally speaking, with really low interest rates and potentially interest rates rising over time, bonds don't sound like an exciting option. I think that if you look at not just how bonds are doing in the United States, but how they're doing in other countries, maybe how they're doing in some emerging debt, you know, if you look along from really, really healthy bonds in the corporate world down to junk bonds, there's so many more bonds than just your very traditional, you know, basically something that's really reliant on interest rates. Because if we know interest rates are eventually going to go up, which we kind of do because they're zero, almost zero, then you don't want to buy bonds, because that's bad for bonds when interest rates go up in the short term. But I say it's still worth having an allocation to bonds, only because everything is so expensive and bonds give you a little bit of that downside protection should we get a massive correction at any time.
Yeah, I guess I'm just not excited by bonds. Like, I just don't see very much like return potential. So like, I'm perfectly fine putting my money in like my safe money in cash. Or I tell people in our investing course, 120 minus your age in stocks and the rest in bonds. So if you're 30, you'd put 90% in stocks, 10% in bonds. 10% in bonds is not going to be enough to really change the game. So, you know, it's more of just a getting used to having bonds in your portfolio, because when you're older, you will need to rely on them a lot more. And so that's why I tell people to do it. If people are like, you know, I'd rather put that in just cash to have it feel more accessible and safe, I'd be okay with that. I'm going to try to make it I'm going to attempt to make kind of a somewhat amusing football analogy here. Bonds are like when University of Florida plays Northwestern Central Appalachian State University football team, in the sense that everybody knows the outcome of the game is probably going to be the Gators are going to win. So it's pretty safe to go take your family there, expect to watch a nice win. There's not a lot of upside in the sense of, you know, probably what's going to happen, but there's a lot of downside, because what happens if that random thing happens and the little upstart school beats your school? Well, then it's like the worst day ever. You're so sad. You're so upset. It just ruins everything. So that's, to me, what investing in bonds is like right now. Like, there's just very little upside and a lot of downside. And the reason why is the stock market like so highly valued? Well, it's because like, if you have the Gators playing the Crimson Tide, that's like, yeah, there's a lot of downside. You could have a miserable day, but it also might be an amazing day. You don't know what's going to happen. And so you feel like, well, I'd rather just take my chances over there with the stock market. So that's going to be like probably at least half of our audience is going to just be like, what the heck did he just say? You know, but I don't know. I'm missing the in-person experiences, entertainment experiences. I'm sure many of our listeners are, that like going to concerts and sporting events and things like that.
Right. I mean, I don't have a great football analogy like that, but what I will say is that I think bonds are extremely, I shouldn't say all bonds, but certain bonds are extremely dangerous to invest in right now, because the upside is that you're stuck with a 1 or 2% rate of return for whatever the term of the bond is. The downside is that the bonds could literally be cut down by like a third or a half if interest rates go back up to 4 or 5%, depending on like how long, you know. I won't get too technical. What I suggest people do, this is not financial advice, this is just my opinion, right? We have to have that disclaimer. This is not investment advice. But anyone who has any type of debt, a mortgage, credit card debt, you know, student debt, if the best way for you to go about it is by refinancing and paying it off aggressively, you don't have any forgiveness option or income-driven repayment, take that percentage of the allocation that would go towards bonds and put it towards paying back that debt instead. Even if you have a mortgage at 2.75%, every dollar that you pay down that mortgage, you're getting an immediate tax-free 2.75% return on that money, which is much better than the bond market right now in a lot of sectors. So one of the things to think about is if you have an 80-20, keep that 80 and put it into stocks, take that 20 and pay extra on your mortgage, or definitely pay down your credit card debt. And if you are do have private student loans, even if they're super low, pay those off even faster. That way you're kind of maximizing the return. You're going to free up that cash flow for your personal situation and have more money to invest if/when the bubble does burst.
What are your opinions about Robinhood? So, I mean, a lot of these sort of day trading type of places have come into prominence recently. What is your opinion about everything that's happened with just how many people have turned to day trading? I think, Molly, you mentioned that your hairdresser is giving you stock tips these days. What are your thoughts on all these different companies that tell people they're investing?
I think that everyone has the right to play in a market like this. So I think that's what we're seeing, that everybody is putting their money in, seeing these crazy numbers on the news about a 300% return in a week or in a day. As a professional investor, I would say that there's a massive danger there. You're trading on something because you've heard other people are trading on it, not because you know anything about the actual company. So if you want to get in and play and have some fun and put some money in there and see if you can get a 300% return and then ideally sell and save some money for taxes, then do it. But I think that we see trend following happen a lot in the Robinhood type of space with all the Reddit folks basically getting in there, seeing that somebody's trading on a stock, seeing that, you know, we're going to screw over the hedge funds. And if you're doing that for fun and with a little bit of extra money, I have no problem with it. I think that you can't ignore the dangers involved in trading on something that you don't necessarily understand why it's trading the way it's trading.
Yeah, totally agree. So personal experience, I day traded in the 90s. And even coming out of the recession, I was actually trading options and stocks and stuff like that after the fact, before I was like a professional investment manager. I can tell you that I was an absolute genius for a couple of years. And then I was an absolute idiot when things crashed. First of all, if people are interested in it, I think they should absolutely do it. Because if the best way to learn how to invest and how to get good at stock picking is to do it. The thing is that we don't want to get overconfident and that we don't want to use too much money that's going to really wreck our finances if we lose it. Because what I learned, if you want to be a good investor and you want to pick good stocks, it takes a lot of work. You got to put a lot of research in. You got to know these companies cold. Often it's talking with the management companies to see what their prospects are. You kind of need, everyone's going, trying to make all these returns and beat the stock market. So you really have to go like the extra mile, do the deep homework and have a philosophy that you can stick to. Doing it even a couple hours a day, if you have 5 stocks in your portfolio, to me is not enough time to really get a good handle on research and what you own. Now, there are times where you can get lucky. There are times when you can be smart, like actually smart and make a good decision. What I found is that even the best investors, maybe 50% of the time they pick a winner and 50% of the time they pick a loser. But it's all about getting out, not getting greedy and getting out, and then also minimizing the downside. So if every 10 stock picks you make, 5 go up and 5 go down, if you cut the losses on the ones that go down and let the ones that are going up run a little bit more, if that's possible to do, then you'll have a positive return. But it gets really dangerous. I don't want anyone to think that they're a genius right now. You might be, but we won't know that until there's actually like a recession or the bubble burst. Like Warren Buffett says, you know, we'll know who's wearing their bathing suit when the tide pulls out, right? So just be careful. That's all I'm going to say. I think it's good to do. I think if it's fun for you, it's something you should do, but just make sure you're not risking anything significant to learn how to do it.
So I have to tell a personal story here. Someone I would classify as close to me, a close friend, was involved in the Wall Street Bet stuff. And little known to myself, he invested about $5,000 in it. You know, a lot of times, like, I guess people know that I'm in the personal finance space. So like when something's really hot or active, they'll sometimes send me a message, people I haven't heard from in a while kind of thing. They'll send me a message, hey, can we chat? Like, I have this weird thing that I'm going through. And I'm always, usually if someone's a good friend, I'm like, yeah, sure, why not, right? So this was a weird one. This guy had turned $5,000 into about $190,000.
Wow.
First, he turned it into like $100,000. And this guy is someone I would classify as like not really fully employed. Like there's no regular source of income for this person. You know, I mean, obviously I didn't time it correctly because I was saying, hey, you know, you should probably sell this when it was at $100,000. And then I remember seeing just like the melt up that was happening, having that trader instincts. Like you have to at least have some level of like, what's the momentum here and what does it feel like? Because you can really tell sometimes, at least like you start hearing people saying certain things. It's like, oh my gosh, the greed emotion is fully activated right now. And so I remember I called my buddy and I just said on the day that it was like 200 to 400-ish, and when it was melting up towards the 400 range, and I said, can I just say this? If you sell now, this is going to be a story we're going to be talking about at the bar for the next 50 years. And if you don't, you know, I mean, if it goes up even more, you're going to be like, oh man. But like, if it goes down, you're going to feel like terrible, because this money is like enough where you could maybe even put a huge down payment down on a house. And finally, the person was like, but Travis, apes together strong. I was like, wait, what? That's the Wall Street Bets meme talk for like the Planet of the Apes movie, where like they say apes together are strong. That's a big part of the meme culture in this like Reddit sub forum, because it's like they joke around like how they're just a bunch of apes playing the market kind of thing. That's kind of one of their jokes that they'll make. And so they have this whole subculture, and I uncovered like he literally felt shame getting rid of his position because he was trying to make a statement about hedge funds and like the market and everything. And so that's just so unconnected with what investing really is. Luckily, he did end up selling, and then the thing went down 90%. So
he won the lottery.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is I also know somebody that ended up with a net worth when he retired that was 100 times what his maximum annual career salary was. This person got there with just regular investing, Rob, doing what you were talking about, reading reports on individual stocks. And so what's more impressive? Somebody that took a big gamble, held on, sold at the right time. Well, that's something that requires a massive amount of luck. Whereas somebody that is slowly building wealth over time, very intentionally, regular investing contributions, it requires some luck, because if you did it right before the Great Depression, it would have maybe taken a while for you to recover. But it's mostly skill and behavioral control. And so when you invest $10,000 in, say, an index fund of American companies, what are you actually buying?
Yeah, you're buying a stake in the business. Just rewinding for a second, if you take a look at the best, most successful investors of all time, the Buffetts, Peter Lynch, Bogle, Jeremy Grantham, all those people, they are all long-term investors, long-term holders of investment. There aren't any day traders on that list as most successful investors of all time, kind of to your point. So then going back to what exactly are you buying? So you're buying a stake in the company. It could be, it's a tiny stake in the company, but nonetheless, you're buying a stake. So whatever happens with the company, you are the beneficiary of. Now with publicly traded companies, it's a little bit different. If you own a private company or like a private practice, like a private dental practice or medical practice, the value of your stake is based upon your bonus checks, your profit sharing, and all that stuff. Now you get all that when you invest in stocks too, but because it's publicly traded and priced depending on the day, you're actually getting price appreciation that you can tangibly see, or loss of, or price depreciation that you can tangibly see on a minute by minute basis. But in the end, if you own Apple, you actually own a piece of Apple. You are a 1/1,000,000th of a percent of a shareholder of Apple if you have $10,000 or whatever.
Molly, what do you think?
Yeah. Completely right, Rob, what you said about owning the company. This comes back a little bit to the bond hating we've done today. If you own a medical practice, or if you are a physician or a dentist, your career and your earnings are more like a bond. So go ahead and own those companies, because your earnings, people are going to continue to get sick, get cavities. They're going to continue to need medical help. So your career and those earnings are a bond. Go ahead and own pieces of companies that you find attractive, or go ahead and buy an index fund that will own a bunch of those. And that way you can watch the market go up and down, but and know that you're participating in it, but you've got a really safe source of growing wealth by just going to the office every day.
Yeah. Just in general with investing right now, if we're worried that investing is a bubble, a good response is to just try to make sure that we have a good amount of emergency funds, max out your 401k, contribute maybe at least $100 a month to some sort of brokerage account like a Vanguard or a Betterment Digital Advisor Services. Both of those will do it for you for almost nothing in terms of fees. What do you guys think about deleveraging right now? So say somebody is like doing all those things and they have some student loans that they know they need to pay down. a lot of people would argue against this, and I can see a good reason to argue against it if you're like a business owner or an aspiring business owner trying to focus on like having a lot of savings to start a business venture. But if you're in a stable situation, what's so bad about paying down some student loans right now if that's something you know you need to do?
Good question. So I'll say that I'm like a recovering wealth optimizer, kind of making all decisions based upon how the numbers play out. You know, borrow money at 3% because if you invest, you can earn 7%, or why pay off your mortgage when you can do this instead? As I've gotten older and as I've seen more people's specific situations, deleveraging to me is always a good plan. Having money left over in the first place is number one, the most important thing you can do to be financially successful. What you do with that money is secondary, but you take risk off the table when you don't have debt, and it also lowers your cost of living so that you can retire early and be financially independent sooner. And that spread, you know, investing versus paying off your mortgage is not nearly as important as the cash flow freedom and as important as the comfort that people feel by just being debt-free.
Yeah, Molly.
I grew up actually in a debt is toxic household, so much so that I paid my student loans off probably more quickly than I should have. So coming from that bias, I certainly say that as long as your cash flow is handled, as long as you have emergency savings, you know, if you do have some extra cash, why not? Why not pay down the debt?
Yeah, I just kind of look at it like one great thing to do, like one reason we talk about this concept called the refinancing ladder is because it allows you to keep your monthly payment about the same on your student loans or continue to reduce it over time, or like reduce your student loans over, you know, over time. So you start off with like a 20-year fixed rate, you pay down a lot of it, and then you refinance it again to like a 15 or a 10-year, and the monthly payment might be about the same because you pay down a lot of the debt. And so they re-amortize the loan, and then you have a payment that's about the same with the lower interest rate, and then you pay out even more, and then you get down to a 5-year, and the payment is maybe still about the same. So I like the idea of reducing that required monthly payment a lot. I think that right now, like a lot of people, when you're kind of wondering, like, what do I do with this extra money that I have? If you do need to pay down your student loans, if you know that you're not a good candidate for loan forgiveness long-term, I think a fantastic use of capital over and above the minimum you need for an emergency fund is to pay down student loans and just deleverage. Like when in doubt, just get less debt on the balance sheet, even if it theoretically makes sense to carry it. I don't know. That seems like a great use of money to me right now. It's just getting rid of some of this debt. One quick last question. So I've been kind of thinking that the advice we should be giving people is if you're in the private sector right now, your debt-to-income ratio is 1.25 to 1 or better, and you want to pay your loans off longer than 5 years, like you know it's going to take you more than 5 years, it's not a terrible thing to refinance federal student loans right now, even though it's a 0%, just because I am very nervous about where interest rates are going to go between now and September. What do you think? Crazy idea or something people could consider?
I think generally speaking that the federal government is really afraid to raise interest rates and to have that go through the economy because we know that there will be some negative implications. But I think we've been at zero for so long. I think there's going to be some testing of that. I think they're going to try a little bit at a time. So I think we're going to see some sort of increase.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's a personal choice. If someone misses out on the lowest of the low, it's sort of like trying to time the market, right? You're trying to time interest rates. To me, if you know you're going to refinance, then, you know, just get going on it, right? If you know that's the best long-term strategy, then just do it. Pull the trigger, take action, get it in motion. If you're uncertain or if you need to clean up some other things in your financial life, like if you need to pay off credit card debt, if you are saving up for practice ownership, things that are going to give you a better return on your money, then you could wait. You know, take advantage of the 0%, not having to put money towards it, and then just wait. But only if there is a better use of what your money can do for you today. So again, you can use that interest rate example where, like, if you have a credit card debt at 15%, paying that off during this period of time is much better than refinancing.
Of course, yeah.
And if you don't have an emergency fund set up, like, definitely do that first. I'd say once you have your financial foundation set up and you know you're going to do it, no harm in doing it now.
Yeah, I'm thinking like $300,000 income, dentist owes $250,000. If I'm going to buy a house in 6 months and you could give me the choice between a 0% rate for 6 months and then whatever the rate's going to be in September, or I could lock in 2.75 now on my mortgage that I'm going to buy in 6 months, I would much rather have the 2.75 right now, because I think it's probably something that's going to be with me for a while. Molly made a great point about the short-term rates. They might go gradually with it, but short-term rates, as we know, are a lot more stable than long-term rates, which the Federal Reserve probably will have less control over. And when they start moving, I think they're going to move fast, but they might not move for 10 years, you know, or 20 years. It might be a long time. So I guess if people were going to refinance though, like that's where I would feel comfortable with it, is people are going to take longer than 5 years. The balance sheets are rock solid. They really like the idea of just getting a really great rate now and not wondering when it's going to be in 6 months. And then you can also wait 30 days after applying before finally accepting the offer and get that full 0% subsidy in their interim. So I don't know. It's just something that I've been thinking about a lot lately, just trying to make sure we give people the best advice on refinancing. Molly, do you have any other tips?
I think we can't forget the federal protection, right? Yeah, when it's very clear that you need to refinance and there's not really an option in the income-driven repayment world for you, then yes. But yeah, we can't forget that, you know, if you want to maintain that zero payment and a little bit more flexibility over the next several months, then absolutely stay on the federal side. But if it's the math is just absolutely clear that you need to refinance, then now's a pretty good time.
Yeah. I mean, I would never be upset with somebody choosing not to refinance. It's mostly, I'm talking about like the slam dunk. Oh my gosh, this person's making a lot of money and they're going to pay their loans off. No problem, right? So, well, this has been a really fascinating conversation. We got to have this be a more regular thing, talking investments with you guys. It's a lot of fun. How about our listeners enjoyed it too? And I'll say, you know, Rob and Molly, while we're not able to give investment advice specifically on our consults, we are investment professionals in the sense that we come from this world. We know a lot of this stuff. Just because we don't give specific investment advice doesn't mean that we're not aware of everything going on, that we can't point you to resources or tools or things you need to be thinking of when we're doing our student loan consultations, getting you the best student loan plan that are going to make you as wealthy as possible long-term too. So thank you guys so much for being on today's show.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to be here.